Thank you for that reading. It was a hard one, all those Old Testament names. I know you're all thinking, I'm glad I wasn't rostered on this week. You always just say them with confidence because nobody really knows how they're meant to be said. One of my favourite movies is a movie, The Castle. Has anybody ever seen the movie, The Castle? All right. Do you know any of the famous lines? It's actually passed into folklore and Australian culture, you see. Do you know any of the famous lines from The Castle? Any quotes? Tell him he's dreaming. That's right. How much does he want for those jousting sticks? Tell him he's dreaming. Any of the other lines that you know from it? That's going straight to the pool room. So when his daughter, the guy is a hero of the story, when his daughter brings back her certificate from the Sunshine TAFE for a hairdressing course, he says that's going straight to the pool room. Any other lines that you know? What do you call this, love? So the character, the main character, he's just so always grateful for his wife's cooking, so his wife, you know, brings out anything, and he says, oh, what do you call this, love? Sponge cake, Dale. And what's this on top? Icing sugar. You should open a shop. All right? So go and watch it. It's fantastic, fantastic movie. One of the lines that he says repeatedly in the story is, how's the serenity? All right, as they're up at their lake with their speedboat standing under the power lines. Anyway, he says, how's the serenity? It's a great line. So obviously a few of you need to watch The Castle because those lines are pretty famous and you'd hate to miss out, wouldn't you? And I was thinking about this idea of how's the serenity, and in fact the story, like the pattern of the story of The Castle, and I guess it's the pattern of many movies and many novels and many stories, is that of a loving family who go through turmoil because, in fact, people, in a sense, attack them financially. They try and buy their home, resume it for the airport. And so he's in distress, and then someone comes along who can actually help him, and then it is resolved, and once again the family's able to say, how's the serenity, as they recover their serenity. And that kind of arc of the story is exactly what we have here in Deborah's story. And as we said, it's the recurring pattern in the book of Judges. Now, our story, about 1200 BC, actually takes place at a major turning point in technology. As I said, the Bronze Age morphs into the Iron Age. And that's crucial in this story. One of the reasons that the bad guys can oppress the children of Israel is they have chariots. And when they say iron chariots, they mean that the wheels actually have iron around them. And that makes them much sturdier. And the children of Israel have bronze weapons instead of iron. So iron's much stronger than bronze, right? So their iron weapons are much stronger, their chariots are faster, and the children of Israel just can't compete. And so for 20 years they've been oppressed by the Canaanites. Now, interestingly enough, this story is told twice. And if you go and look in the script, you'll actually see that chapter 4 is a telling of the story and chapter 5 is a retelling as a poem. Now, we think that the poem is the oldest version. And that kind of makes sense because the whole book of Judges was written after the period of the Judges. And Deborah's story happens early. And so the poem is the oldest telling of the story, all right, because the book is at least written several hundred years later. And the poem tells us some really interesting things that aren't in the chapter 4 telling of the story. It tells us that their way of life as the children of Israel was being destroyed. And so the solution is to go to war against their oppressors. Now, I have to tell you that this is, in a way, a deeply disturbing story. And it's a bit like Ehud, you know. So Ehud, that's kind of a shocking story that involves a bad guy being killed. And this story is the same, where the bad guy is killed. In fact, killed by a woman, just as Deborah predicts, in an underhanded and treacherous way that breaks half of the commandments. Now, I have experienced treacherous violence from a woman. before Sharon and I were married, and you may not believe this, but I was kind of ripped, you know, and had a washboard stomach, and I wanted to show this off to Sharon. So I said, I clenched my stomach and I said, "Sharon, punch me in the stomach. That's like a rock." And she said, "I don't want to punch you in the stomach." And I said, "No, go on, go on. It's rock hard." She said, "I'm not going to punch you in the stomach." And just as she said that, I relaxed. And then she punched me, not in the stomach, but in the heart. Knocked me over. I said, "What did you do that for?" And she said, "You told me to punch you." Now, I was shocked and surprised by this attack. And I'd like to say that I was brave, but I think I was just lying back on the beanbag going, "You punched me." Well, the violence in this story is far worse than that, as we will see, in terms of how this woman actually takes the life of the bad guy in the story. So just to remind ourselves who the players are in the story. So we have, first of all, Jabin. So he's kind of a shadowy figure. He's listed as the king of this particular city that's oppressing them. But he doesn't really play a role in the story. The bad guy who has an active role in the story is the general, Sisera, who's the leader of King Jabin's forces. Now, we know that Sisera is a bad man. In fact, we know even more so. It wasn't just that he oppressed Israel. So at the end of the poem, at the end of chapter 5, it actually has his mother waiting for him, and he's not returning, right? Because, you know, he's going to get killed in this story. And she says he's probably taking his time because he's robbing them to bring back more plunder, and he and his soldiers are raping the women as she waits for him to return. It's in fact, the actual Hebrew, it's kind of softened in the NIV. It's actually quite graphic in the Hebrew what she says. So she's just waiting for the spoils of war, acknowledging what her wicked son is doing. But we have three good guys, and they are Deborah, who is the wise judge, a woman judge, which was pretty rare. There's only a couple of other instances in Scripture where there's mention of a wise person or a prophetess who actually plays a particular role. But Deborah was a good one. And so she's not so much a judge of law, of criminal activity, saying guilty or not guilty. She's a judge in the sense she's deciding between. Deciding between. So people went to her for wise counsel. She was a sage in Israel, someone who was close to God, who they recognised as particularly important. And that was necessary in an Israel that was a troubled place, really. And then there's Jael, and she's kind of an enigmatic figure because it's not really clear in the story why she will act the way she does. You see, she's not actually an Israelite. She's from a people called the Kenites. And if you've read Moses' story, you'll know that Moses actually married a woman from the Kenites. And so they had been friends of Israel. But at this point of the story, they're also friends with Canaan. And they're actually allies of Canaan. They are not enemies. So they were at peace with them. And eventually that we understand that's why Sisera actually goes to this woman, because he thinks she's an ally. And in fact, that turns out not to be true. And in fact, it is Jael who kills Sisera. And that's kind of hard to understand, how God is working through this particular, what is essentially like a murder, this dramatic reversal. Now, in the book of Judges, it has to be said that this is not close. What she does is not even close to the most brutal act. Honestly, Judges is a brutal book, if you read those stories. It's just extraordinary. And in fact, normally women are the victims in most of this. And death may be an appropriate punishment for this awful man, Sisera. But the road to it seems kind of torturous. She, in fact, lies to him and deceives him. It's hard to understand that in a way, but what we do know is that God used Jael for the purpose of defeating Israel's enemy, even if we don't understand her motives. Now, the last person is Barak, and that's a name we kind of know well now, isn't it? Now, in that NIV reading we had, he's kind of portrayed as a bit of a weak figure, and he says to Deborah, I'm not going to go unless you go. And she says, all right, but because you're sooky about it, the glory's not going to be yours. That's not really, it's kind of ambiguous, and the NIV has decided on one side of the ambiguity to portray Barak and in a particular way. That's not certainly how his character's always been understood. So if you read the book of Hebrews, towards the end of Hebrews or in the middle of Hebrews, there's a big long list of the heroes of the faith, and Barak is listed among them. He's regarded as a hero of the faith because, in fact, he refuses to go up against Israel's enemy unless he goes with the Lord. He will not fight Israel's enemies without the Lord's presence. And in fact, he's very content to leave the victory to God in whatever bizarre fashion. And it doesn't matter to him that the victory will come at the hands of a woman. And he's held up as a model of faith. This is what he says, the words I'm talking about. He says, Barak said to Deborah, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you'll not go with me, I will not go. She said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, so she's just sure. She says, it's not a problem. Of course I'll go with you. Nevertheless, you need to understand, the honour shall not be yours on the journey that you're about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. And that's kind of a bit different to the NIV translation. So Barak's request is a gracious and insistent invitation to Deborah as God's prophet to join him so that she might bless their military expedition and she might share in the glory of the Lord's victory over Sisera. And there's kind of echoes of Moses in this story. I don't know if you remember that story of Moses at the burning bush where God says to him, you need to go and free my people. And he says, I'm not good enough. I don't want to go. And the Lord says to Moses, I will go with you. You know, Lord, if your presence does not go with us, that kind of idea. So this is a story about God and the people of God and God's activity and plans. Israel cannot find peace. They cannot find serenity. They themselves are in turmoil. The only solution is the deliverance of God. And God delivers his people in an amazing array of ways through the book of Judges. What's boring in Judges is actually their sin and failure. It's boring and repetitive. God's saving is extraordinary, and we have to confess it's puzzling. So what is the story, you ask? So Barak goes to war. He assembles his troops, and off they go. And they march down to this river, and Sisera hears that the army has been sent against him, so he gathers his troops, and his chariots are made of iron. And there's a battle ensues. And what we discover from the poem is that there's a flood. And while iron chariots, which are heavy, are great when the ground is dry, they're not so great when the ground is boggy, and the chariots get bogged. And the Israelites are triumphant. And Sisera, in fact, because his chariot won't move, we find this out in the story, he steps out of his chariot and he runs to actually escape the vengeance of the Israelites. And he actually goes to Jael, who is an ally. And he says to her, I'm exhausted, I'm fleeing the Israelites, will you look after me? And she says, no problem, come inside. So he comes inside and he says, I'm thirsty. And she said, I'll get you a drink of milk. So she gets him a drink of milk, adds a drink of milk, and in the one version he falls asleep. And while he falls asleep, and this is what the picture is actually, I don't know if you've seen it in the picture, she gets a hammer and a tent peg, and she drives a tent peg through his forehead. Is that not gruesome? All right. That's a pretty surprising way for the bad guy to die. It's pretty surprising that in some way this has been foreseen by God and that this is God's action. You know, what are we to make of a story like this? Now, we would recognise that he deserves it, right? So in the poem, there's an echo here of the abuse of women that Sisera has enacted. So at the end of the poem, Sisera's mother says there's a womb or two for every soldier. That's literally what she says. And here in the story, in this ironic reversal in the poem, he dies at the feet of a woman. But what are we to make of this story? How does this help us in our faith? Well, in a sense, there's eternal truths here. You see, for every group of God's people, for every individual, there'll always be a King Jabin, the shadowy figure that represents a culture that is foreign and alien to God. There'll always be a Sisera. We come up against people who are enemies in our lives, who throw our lives into turmoil. They'll have new names, those that oppose God, but we'll always live in a Canaan. We'll always live as strangers in a strange land. You see, the problem that the Israelites had was that they were constantly seduced by the culture around them. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. Most of the time, it was not that they did not keep serving the God of Israel. It was that they added the other gods in. It's what they call syncretism. It's where you keep your own faith, but you grab a bit out of every other faith as well. And somehow the worship and the gods of the Canaanites were attractive to them. It was a bit like they'd have a bet both ways. We've got our God and we'll want to pray to this one as well. They lived in a culture that was seducing them away from God, that was taking them away from God's holiness. And the only solution that we see in the actions of Barak and Deborah, the only solution is to go with God. Now, does anybody know how to say go with God in Spanish? It's in movies sometimes. Do you remember? Vaya con Dios. All right? Now, go with God. Go with God. Vaya con Dios. And if you don't remember anything else from either Ecuador, the sermon, the lollies, the quiz from Judges, the Vaya con Dios bit, remember that. Because that was the point of this story. This good man, Barak, went with God. He followed God's will at the advice of the wise counsel of Deborah. Because in this story, it is God who is a deliverer. We believe that God works all things together. And when we say that, we don't just mean good things. God works evil, selfish actions into his plans and purposes. God works all things together. So in the poem, we find that the flood bogs the chariots and Sisera runs. In this story, we find that the men of the story have not reckoned with the women who are the real heroes, Deborah and Jael. Nor have they reckoned with the God of Israel, against whom no human army can stand. And thus, Deborah and Barak and Jael and God upend the prideful plans of Sisera and his Canaanite soldiers. They got no spoils of war, the text tells us. And Sisera fell between Jael's feet, and there he fell dead. And I think in a way this can be a comfort to us, that God uses sinners in his plans. Because you and I are sinners saved by grace. And we're certainly hoping that God will use us, flawed as we are. There's that interesting verse in the book of Philippians where Paul talks about people who are preaching the gospel out of envy and rivalry and ambition. And he says, I rejoice anyway because the gospel is being preached. God uses sinful people for his purposes. When I was at the International College for Officers, one of the things you have to do is you have to share your story. And one of the guys from North America, a great guy called Phil, talked about the fact that he'd been a really troubled young boy. His dad had died and he was just really off the rails until he encountered the Salvation Army and encountered a particular officer who took him under his wing and mentored him and brought him to faith and brought him to Jesus Christ. And in a marvellous way, he was saved and his life was turned around. The life of his whole family was influenced by this. But what troubled Phil was that he later found out that, in fact, at that very time, his mentor was a bad person. He was doing wrong, bad things. And this kind of ate at him. Was my salvation, was his mentorship flawed? Was it real? Well, of course it was. God uses sinful people. He uses you and me, all right? Even sometimes when our motives aren't right, even when our actions might be wrong, God uses them. He is God after all. God's plans are not thwarted by our sin. Now in this story, our story doesn't end with a happily ever after, but it does kind of end with a serenity moment. And it says, and the land had rest for 40 years. So on that day, the Lord subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, and the land had rest for 40 years. It's an interesting word, this word rest. It's a verb. It's to rest, all right? Kind of active rest, if you like. Not just a description of something. And this idea that there was peace and quiet. That's a phrase we use, isn't it? Peace and quiet. I just need some peace and quiet, we say, when our lives are in turmoil. Our hearts might cry out for the peace of God. And so often in our songs, in our hymnody, that's kind of the songs that touch us. You know, we sing, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll. Or we sing peace, perfect peace. Or we long for the stillness of God, drop thy still dews of quietness till all my striving cease. It's this idea that that's what we're made for. St. Augustine talked about this. He talked about our restlessness without God, the turmoil that is in us until we can find rest and serenity and peace in God. You and I can find rest in God through Christ. So what is God doing in this ancient story? Because while it's an ancient story, in a sense, it's a true story for us right now. We live in Canaan. At some time in our lives, we might have met our Sisera. We might have met our oppressor. Sometimes our lives can be in turmoil because of our kids, because of our grandkids, because of work, because of our finances. We might be in turmoil in our inner being with our own sense of self and who we are. But this story reminds us that the only solution is this, that we must act on the will of God, seeking the presence of God and trusting in the deliverance of God. We act on the will of God, seeking the presence of God, trusting in the deliverance of God. And what matters is that we follow his leading, that we take his presence with us, just like Barak did. I will not go unless you come with me, he said to Deborah. We need to trust God to work out his purposes to deliver us. And it's not do nothing, right? If anything, this is an action story, right? People are doing stuff the whole way through here. And God helps those who help themselves. It's not a Bible verse, just in case I need to clarify that. It's not in the Bible, but it's good advice nonetheless. God helps those who help themselves. This is a story of decisive and faithful action. And here's the thing. Which bit was God's doing and which was theirs? Well, we wouldn't know. We can't tell because God works through our actions. We are still required to do something. Barak went to war, Deborah did too, and Jael most certainly acted. They might have gotten it wrong, but God was at work. You see, our sin and our weakness are spectacular only in their absolute predictability and uniformity. But God's deliverance is truly awesome. We look back at our lives and we see the hand of God. We know that he's at work. We know that as his people, we can trust him to deliver us. We know that we too can find rest in him. And if your life is in turmoil, if in the lives of people around you, their lives are in turmoil, the only solution is to act on the will of God, seeking the presence of God, trusting in the deliverance of God. And when we do so, we will have rest.